This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 2001 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Where will John be able to find out what is happening in the World Tennis Tournament?
Join us on Radio Channel 5 at 8 o'clock tonight for the highlights of the World Tennis Championship. Join us on Radio Channel 5 at 8 o'clock tonight for the highlights of the World Tennis Championship.
Question 2. Imran needs to know which page to turn to and which exercises to do for homework. Give details of both items.
I've lost that note about our geography homework, Abel. Which exercises were we supposed to do? And where's the information on volcanoes?
You'll find volcanoes on page 298, Imran. And then we have to do exercises A to F by tomorrow morning.
I've lost that note about our geography homework, Abel. Which exercises were we supposed to do? And where's the information on volcanoes?
You'll find volcanoes on page 298, Imran. And then we have to do exercises A to F by tomorrow morning.
Question 3. What is the time of the train which takes passengers to Paris more quickly?
Which is the faster train, the 808 or the 845?
Well, the second train arrives first because the earlier train stops at lots of small stations on the way.
Which is the faster train, the 808 or the 845?
Well, the second train arrives first because the earlier train stops at lots of small stations on the way.
Question 4. Chrysanthi is in the supermarket when she hears the following announcement. What should she do?
Customer announcement. We will be testing our fire systems at 10 o'clock this morning. You will hear a series of loud alarm bells. You don't need to take any action. This is a test only. Thank you. Customer announcement. We will be testing our fire systems at 10 o'clock this morning. you will hear a series of loud alarm bells. You don't need to take any action. This is a test only. Thank you.
Question 5. Thomas is going to be visiting his friend by car for the first time. After the E45, which road and which direction should he take?
Do you have a road map, Thomas? Follow the E45 as far as Junction 1, then go south down the N23 until you meet the D12. Our house faces directly onto the D12, just outside of Argouges. Do you have a road map, Thomas? Follow the E45 as far as Junction 1, then go south down the N23 until you meet the D12. Our house faces directly onto the D12, just outside of Argouges.
Question 6. Your pen friend wants you to send a list of possible dates for visits. What is the way he wants you to contact him? And why?
Let me know which dates would be convenient for you to come and visit me. Write me a letter or phone me. Actually, no, it's quicker to send me an email. The address for that is andreas@abcnet.com. Let me know which dates would be convenient for you to come and visit me. Write me a letter or phone me. Actually, no, it's quicker to send me an email. The address for that is andreas@abcnet.com.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part 2. Part 2, Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about the career of an airline pilot. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to It's My Career. Tonight, Jane Pearson, a casualty nurse turned airline pilot, has come to talk to us about her career change. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please, could you tell us something about yourself?
Yes. I'm 45 and I live on the outskirts of Manchester. I currently fly planes for a company called Airway Tours and earn £55,000 per year. I was originally a nurse and worked in the casualty department of a hospital, which is where all accident and emergency patients are first admitted. It was a pretty stressful job, actually. After 15 years in my first career, though, I decided to train as a pilot. That was in 1990.
Why did you decide specifically to leave nursing and to become a pilot in your mid-30s?
Well, at that time, I was working in Bermuda as a nurse. I knew that I wanted a different long-term career. When I was a teenager, I used to fly gliders as a hobby, so I got my private pilot's license. I returned to Britain, still working as a nurse, and studied for my flying exams by home study and a special 2-week intensive residential course. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I built up my flying hours. By that I mean the number of hours of flying experienced, so that when I qualified as a commercial pilot, I had clocked up enough hours to get a job with a commercial airline. I didn't start to fly jets, though, until I started my current job with Airway Tours in 1994.
What do you fly at present?
Mainly Boeing 767s out of Manchester Airport. I do short-haul and long-haul flights. Short-haul could be within Britain and Europe, and long-haul flights usually means taking passengers right to the other side of the world.
Are people or passengers surprised when they find out that you're a pilot?
Sometimes, yes. Some men automatically assume I'm cabin crew, an airline stewardess, perhaps. Oh, actually, this is quite a compliment to me, as cabin staff always seem to be so young and attractive. They're often surprised when they hear Captain Jane over the tannoy when announcements are given. At Airway Tours, only 7 out of 350 pilots are women, but I'm hoping this situation will improve.
Hmm. Can you describe a typical long-haul day for us?
I have to be at the airport 1.5 hours before takeoff. So, for example, if I'm flying to Mexico, I have a cup of tea and leave home at about 9:30, as I need to be at work for 10 o'clock. Once there, I receive a flight plan, which is entered into the aircraft's navigation computer. I check the weather with my first officer and read the current notices to air staff, which warn of any changes en route.
Mm-hmm.
When the technicalities have been completed, I introduce myself to my 9 cabin crew and board the plane 45 minutes before takeoff. When we're airborne, we use autopilot, and I adjust that as we fly, taking into account air traffic control instructions, altitude limitations, or course alterations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the crew eat on board. I never eat the same as my co-pilot in case we both fall ill as a result.
Mm.
Then we fly for 10 hours. There's a 2-day recovery period before we have to fly back. On that particular flight to Mexico, we leave at 4 in the afternoon, local time, and arrive back in Manchester at 6 o'clock the following morning.
You must find the different time zones around the world quite a problem when you're flying.
Yes, that's true.
Have you ever encountered any other problems in the air?
Well, in the 9 years in which I've flown for airlines, I've only had to divert once for the weather. I've had some systems failures, but nothing drastic. The main problem for me is the delay often caused by waiting for a slot for takeoff and landing. There's often a queue of us aircraft stacked circling in the sky above airports, waiting for space to land.
Yes. Jane Pearson, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening and welcome to It's My Career. Tonight, Jane Pearson, a casualty nurse turned airline pilot, has come to talk to us about her career change. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please, could you tell us something about yourself?
Yes. I'm 45 and I live on the outskirts of Manchester. I currently fly planes for a company called Airway Tours and earn £55,000 per year. I was originally a nurse and worked in the casualty department of a hospital, which is where all accident and emergency patients are first admitted. It was a pretty stressful job, actually. After 15 years in my first career, though, I decided to train as a pilot. That was in 1990.
Why did you decide specifically to leave nursing and to become a pilot in your mid-30s?
Well, at that time, I was working in Bermuda as a nurse. I knew that I wanted a different long-term career. When I was a teenager, I used to fly gliders as a hobby, so I got my private pilot's license. I returned to Britain, still working as a nurse, and studied for my flying exams by home study and a special 2-week intensive residential course.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I built up my flying hours. By that, I mean the number of hours of flying experienced, so that when I qualified as a commercial pilot, I had clocked up enough hours to get a job with a commercial airline. I didn't start to fly jets, though, until I started my current job with Airway Tours in 1994.
What do you fly at present?
Mainly Boeing 767s out of Manchester Airport. I do short-haul and long-haul flights. Short-haul could be within Britain and Europe, and long-haul flights usually means taking passengers right to the other side of the world.
Are people or passengers surprised when they find out that you're a pilot?
Sometimes, yes. Some men automatically assume I'm cabin crew, an airline stewardess, perhaps. Oh, actually, this is quite a compliment to me, as cabin staff always seem to be so young and attractive. They're often surprised when they hear Captain Jane over the tannoy when announcements are given. At Airway Tours, only 7 out of 350 pilots are women, but I'm hoping this situation will improve.
Hmm. Can you describe a typical long-haul day for us?
I have to be at the airport 1.5 hours before takeoff. So, for example, if I'm flying to Mexico, I have a cup of tea and leave home at about 9:30, as I need to be at work for 10 o'clock. Once there, I receive a flight plan, which is entered into the aircraft's navigation computer. I check the weather with my first officer and read the current notices to air staff, which warn of any changes en route.
Mm-hmm.
When the technicalities have been completed, I introduce myself to my 9 cabin crew and board the plane 45 minutes before takeoff. When we're airborne, we use autopilot, and I adjust that as we fly, taking into account air traffic control instructions, altitude limitations, or course alterations.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the crew eat on board. I never eat the same as my co-pilot in case we both fall ill as a result. Then we fly for 10 hours. There's a 2-day recovery period before we have to fly back. On that particular flight to Mexico, we leave at 4 in the afternoon, local time, and arrive back in Manchester at 6 o'clock the following morning.
You must find the different time zones around the world quite a problem when you're flying.
Yes, that's true.
Have you ever encountered any other problems in the air?
Well, in the 9 years in which I've flown for airlines, I've only had to divert once for the weather. I've had some systems failures, but nothing drastic. The main problem for me is the delay often caused by waiting for a slot for takeoff and landing. There's often a queue of us aircraft stacked circling in the sky above airports waiting for space to land.
Yes. Jane Pearson, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2, Question 8. Listen to the following interview about living conditions for a group of scientists in Antarctica, and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice. Every year, a group of scientists volunteer to go to the Antarctic research base near the South Pole. It's the coldest place on Earth and suffers the most extreme weather. Dr. Tom Hansen is one of the scientists newly returned from a stint in Antarctica. Tom, tell us about the weather there. Was it really very bad living in that lonely Antarctic outpost?
Well, whatever the weather, it's a challenge and an adventure to spend a year at the research base there. It's constantly dark for the 9 months of winter, and at the same time, temperatures are below minus 60 degrees Celsius. It's often very windy, often as much as 96 kilometers per hour. And, of course, there's always the thought that 90% of all the world's ice is at your feet.
I feel cold just thinking about it. What if you get there and decide that you don't like it?
Tough. You're stuck there. During most of the year, planes cannot touch down at the South Pole Research Station in case their landing gear freezes. You can't escape overland because there's nothing but ice for 8,000 miles.
Oh, dear. How can you bear it?
Actually, the Antarctic is very beautiful. When the groups on duty change every November, Antarctica is a continent of soaring blue, white and green icebergs, colonies of giant penguins, snow-laden mountains and solar halos. It's wonderful. Your first impression is of light. Lots of light. It's really breathtaking.
Mm. What about practicalities? What do you eat? Where do you sleep?
Mm. We store meat outside to keep it frozen, and anything we don't want to freeze, drinks for example, we put into the fridge to keep them from freezing. We wear 5 layers of clothing to keep warm, and we each have our own living space. Some scientists live in the central dome. That's cramped living quarters for 33 of the team. But most people live in tents with wooden sides, heated with hot air, or in scientific huts.
And what happens if you're ill?
Obviously, there's a doctor on site, and every operation has to be carried out right there and then in the middle of the Antarctic.
How do you all feel after a year at the research station?
It's funny, but when you return home, nothing seems to be real. The Antarctic weather has a profound effect on you.
Mm.
A barometric air pressure affects you badly there, like a weight continually pushing you down. It's often difficult to breathe, and some people feel nauseous the whole time. Generally, you become tired, unable to think clearly, and you don't sleep well. Scientists who have done several periods of service at the station usually take lots of books with them to study the first time. They find they can't concentrate and instead bring videos with them on their next trip.
And what does your actual work involve?
We record facts about the ozone layer, and we try to study the sun and the universe.
Tom, this was your first year in the Antarctic. Will you be going again?
I'd certainly like to, but not for a few years yet.
Dr. Tom Hansen, thank you very much. Now you will hear the interview again. Every year, a group of scientists volunteer to go to the Antarctic research base near the South Pole. It's the coldest place on Earth and suffers the most extreme weather. Dr. Tom Hansen is one of the scientists newly returned from a stint in Antarctica. Tom, tell us about the weather there. Was it really very bad living in that lonely Antarctic outpost?
Well, whatever the weather, it's a challenge and an adventure to spend a year at the research base there. It's constantly dark for the 9 months of winter, and at the same time, temperatures are below minus 60 degrees Celsius. It's often very windy, often as much as 96 kilometers per hour. And, of course, there's always the thought that 90% of all the world's ice is at your feet.
I feel cold just thinking about it. What if you get there and decide that you don't like it?
Tough. You're stuck there. During most of the year, planes cannot touch down at the South Pole Research Station in case their landing gear freezes. You can't escape overland because there's nothing but ice for 8,000 miles.
Oh, dear. How can you bear it?
Actually, the Antarctic is very beautiful. When the groups on duty change every November, Antarctica is a continent of soaring blue, white and green icebergs, colonies of giant penguins, snow-laden mountains and solar halos. I mean, it's wonderful. Your first impression is of light, lots of light. It's really breathtaking.
Mm. What about practicalities? What do you eat? Where do you sleep?
Mm. We store meat outside to keep it frozen, and anything we don't want to freeze, drinks for example, we put into the fridge to keep them from freezing. We wear 5 layers of clothing to keep warm, and we each have our own living space. Some scientists live in the central dome. That's cramped living quarters for 33 of the team. But most people live in tents with wooden sides, heated with hot air, or in scientific huts.
And what happens if you're ill?
Obviously, there's a doctor on site, and every operation has to be carried out right there and then in the middle of the Antarctic.
How do you all feel after a year at the research station?
It's funny, but when you return home, nothing seems to be real. The Antarctic weather has a profound effect on you.
Mm.
A barometric air pressure affects you badly there, like a weight continually pushing you down. It's often difficult to breathe, and some people feel nauseous the whole time. Generally, you become tired, unable to think clearly, and you don't sleep well. Scientists who have done several periods of service at the station usually take lots of books with them to study the first time. They find they can't concentrate and instead bring videos with them on their next trip.
And what does your actual work involve?
We record facts about the ozone layer, and we try to study the sun and the universe.
Tom, this was your first year in the Antarctic. Will you be going again?
I'd certainly like to, but not for a few years yet.
Dr. Tom Hansen, thank you very much.
That is the end of part two. There will be a short break before you hear part three. Part three is on side two of the cassette. Teacher, please turn over the cassette. Start the tape again at the beginning of side two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. On the 21st of June, 2001, there will be a total eclipse of the sun across parts of southern Africa. Listen to the following extract from a radio program about eclipses and answer the following questions. You will hear the extract twice.
Hello, I'm Tandy Newton, welcoming you to Science Line. Tonight we're going to hear from Peter Hyder, world-famous astronomer and leading authority on solar eclipses. Peter, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Well, please can you tell us first of all what a solar eclipse actually is?
Yes, a total solar eclipse is when the moon comes between the sun and the earth, totally blocking out any light from the sun. As the moon's shadow sweeps across the earth at 3,000 kilometres per hour, certain parts of the world are then plunged into total darkness.
Even though it could be the middle of the day?
Exactly. The temperature drops and so animals think it's time to sleep. There's a written record of an eclipse which took place in the 15th century where we're told that crazed birds fell from the sky and bleating flocks and fearful herds unexpectedly returned to their stables.
So, were people scared by total eclipses in the past?
Oh, certainly so. They were terrified when they saw the sun become dark. For them, it could have been the end of the world, but today we understand eclipses and know when and what to expect.
Mm. So, are eclipses very common?
Yes, indeed. They happen most years. In fact, between 2 and 7 solar eclipses take place each year somewhere on the Earth. Mm. You will have heard of the total eclipse in Europe in 1999.
Mm.
The previous one there was in 1927, and the next will be in 2090.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there's often an eclipse happening elsewhere in the world, and as you know, on the 21st of June 2001, the moon will blot out the sun for 4 minutes and 56 seconds across a broad strip of southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The eclipse will rise in the west and pass across Angola, Zambia, part of northern Zimbabwe, Mozambique and southern Madagascar. A really good place to watch this from might be the Victoria Falls because of its views and its plentiful tourist information.
Mm-hmm. So what will viewers in southern Africa actually see when this total eclipse takes place?
Well, if the weather is clear, first the leading edge of the moon touches the disk of the sun. Light levels will start to fall. Flowers may then close up, and animals might settle down for an early night. Bats may start to fly around, and dogs may howl. Stars and planets may appear. Just before totality, or the climax of the eclipse, occurs, the edge of the moon will acquire blobs of light called Bailey's beads, caused by sunlight shining through the moon's valleys and mountains.
Mm.
These will disappear, and the corona at the rim of the sun will shimmer around the moon's disk.
And if it rains on that day?
It will still become dark, but in that case the best view will be on television, where aircraft flying above the level of the clouds will record the eclipse.
And should people watching the eclipse take any safety precautions with regard to their eyes?
Oh, yes, definitely. Permanent eye damage can and has been sustained by people looking at the sun with the naked eye. Even when you think that the eclipse is virtually total and you can look at the sun quite easily, invisible ultraviolet light will cause eyes serious damage. And if you look at the sun through a telescope or binoculars, it could cause you immediate damage. So use those special eclipse viewing glasses. Please.
Peter, many, many thanks.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Hello, I'm Tandy Newton, welcoming you to Science Line. Tonight we're going to hear from Peter Hyder, world-famous astronomer and leading authority on solar eclipses. Peter, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Well, please can you tell us, first of all, what a solar eclipse actually is?
Yes, a total solar eclipse is when the moon comes between the sun and the earth, totally blocking out any light from the sun. As the moon's shadow sweeps across the earth at 3,000 kilometres per hour, certain parts of the world are then plunged into total darkness.
Even though it could be the middle of the day?
Exactly. The temperature drops and so animals think it's time to sleep. There's a written record of an eclipse which took place in the 15th century where we're told that crazed birds fell from the sky and bleating flocks and fearful herds unexpectedly returned to their stables.
So were people scared by total eclipses in the past?
Oh, certainly so. They were terrified when they saw the sun become dark. For them, it could have been the end of the world, but today we understand eclipses and know when and what to expect.
Mm. So are eclipses very common?
Yes, indeed. They happen most years. In fact, between 2 and 7 solar eclipses take place each year somewhere on the Earth. Mm. You will have heard of the total eclipse in Europe in 1999. Mm. The previous one there was in 1927, and the next will be in 2090. Mm-hmm. As I said, there's often an eclipse happening elsewhere in the world, and as you know, on the 21st of June 2001, the moon will blot out the sun for 4 minutes and 56 seconds across a broad strip of southern Africa. Mm. The eclipse will rise in the west and pass across Angola, Zambia, part of northern Zimbabwe, Mozambique and southern Madagascar. A really good place to watch this from might be the Victoria Falls because of its views and its plentiful tourist information.
Mm-hmm. So what will viewers in southern Africa actually see when this total eclipse takes place?
Well, if the weather is clear, first the leading edge of the moon touches the disk of the sun. Light levels will start to fall. Flowers may then close up, and animals might settle down for an early night. Bats may start to fly around, and dogs may howl. Stars and planets may appear. Just before totality, or the climax of the eclipse, occurs, the edge of the moon will acquire blobs of light called Bailey's beads, caused by sunlight shining through the moon's valleys and mountains. Mm. These will disappear, and the corona at the rim of the sun will shimmer around the moon's disk.
And if it rains on that day?
It will still become dark, but in that case the best view will be on television, where aircraft flying above the level of the clouds will record the eclipse.
And should people watching the eclipse take any safety precautions with regard to their eyes?
Oh, yes, definitely. Permanent eye damage can and has been sustained by people looking at the sun with the naked eye. Even when you think that the eclipse is virtually total and you can look at the sun quite easily, invisible ultraviolet light will cause eyes serious damage. And if you look at the sun through a telescope or binoculars, it could cause you immediate damage. So use those special eclipse viewing glasses, please.
Peter, many, many thanks.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3, Exercise 2. Listen to the following talk about how computers are able to identify us. Then answer the following questions. You will hear the talk twice.
Welcome to our fact file program on computers and identification. Computers in science fiction films often identify people by their voices, think of HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey, or by their fingerprints, or even their eyes. When one very famous starship captain, Captain Kirk, requests top-secret documents, the computer runs a retina scan on his eyes to check his identity. The retina, of course, is the part of the back of the eye which receives the image seen. This all sounds easy and quick and quite credible in the realm of science fiction, but surely it's light years away from real life. Well, no, not now. Similar systems are scheduled to arrive in our own towns within the next decade. Recently, the world's first bank cash machine capable of recognizing the iris, the colored part of the eye, was introduced in Texas. To access the machine and obtain their cash, customers simply insert their card, then stare at the machine. Within years, every cash machine installed should be able to do this identity check in just a few seconds. There will be no need to punch in a secret four-digit number any longer. This is because the colored iris features over 250 measurable characteristics, which are unique to each individual and, indeed, to each eye. Cameras mounted in the machines just need to be able to photograph the eye in order to be able to translate iris patterns into a code unique to the customer. This is how it works. First of all, the user stands within 1 meter of the system at the cash machine. Video cameras locate the user's face and the position of the eye. Secondly, the cameras zoom in on the eye and photograph the iris. Apparently, this even works through contact lenses and spectacles, and even at night. Thirdly, the computer measures the 250-plus characteristics of the iris. And lastly, the measurements are matched and converted into a code, enabling the user to access the machine's services. This all takes place in less time than it takes to tap in a personal four-digit number. Iris recognition is meant to be the most secure method of identification of people, as fingerprints, which are also unique, have only 35 measurable features, and voice analysis has also proved less effective.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Welcome to our fact file program on computers and identification. Computers in science fiction films often identify people by their voices, think of HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey, or by their fingerprints, or even their eyes. When one very famous starship captain, Captain Kirk, requests top secret documents, the computer runs a retina scan on his eyes to check his identity. The retina, of course, is the part of the back of the eye which receives the image seen. This all sounds easy and quick and quite credible in the realm of science fiction, but surely it's light years away from real life. Well, no, not now. Similar systems are scheduled to arrive in our own towns within the next decade. Recently, the world's first bank cash machine capable of recognizing the iris, the colored part of the eye, was introduced in Texas. To access the machine and obtain their cash, customers simply insert their card, then stare at the machine. Within years, every cash machine installed should be able to do this identity check in just a few seconds. There will be no need to punch in a secret four-digit number any longer. This is because the coloured iris features over 250 measurable characteristics, which are unique to each individual and, indeed, to each eye. Cameras mounted in the machines just need to be able to photograph the eye in order to be able to translate iris patterns into a code unique to the customer. This is how it works. First of all, the user stands within 1 meter of the system at the cash machine. Video cameras locate the user's face and the position of the eye. Secondly, the cameras zoom in on the eye and photograph the iris. Apparently, this even works through contact lenses and spectacles, and even at night. Thirdly, the computer measures the 250-plus characteristics of the iris. And lastly, the measurements are matched and converted into a code, enabling the user to access the machine's services. This all takes place in less time than it takes to tap in a personal four-digit number. Iris recognition is meant to be the most secure method of identification of people, as fingerprints, which are also unique, have only 35 measurable features, and voice analysis has also proved less effective.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, center number, and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.